Welcome to Reparations, The Big Payback, a production of Color Farm Media, iHeartRadio, and the Black Effect Podcast Network.
Reparations. What is it? It is the making of amends for a wrong that one has done by paying money to or otherwise helping those who have been wronged. It comes from two words, repair and action. So thus, it is the action of repairing the damage that one has caused. It is a noun. And we need it now.
Ha! You tell them, RZA. You got debt, white America. Protect your neck, Wu-Tang! I'm Erica Alexander.
And I'm Whitney Dow.
There it is. It all comes down to one thing, debt. If we rang up all the debt white Americans owe to black Americans, it would be 50 times longer than a CVS receipt. Picture that, Whitney. That's mighty long. Did you know that you're hundreds of years ahead of me because you were born a white man in America? But you owe me a debt that a simple thank you can't fix.
Well, you know, Erica, I always thank you, but what is this debt that we're talking about? Is it something that I owe you personally, or is this something that all white people owe black people? You know, you're the big star. I'm just a documentary filmmaker. I never enslaved anybody. My relatives, as far as I know, didn't. What is this thing that I actually owe? How has this debt been accrued, and how do you think I should be repaying it?
$1 at a time. You know, we've done this before. It's so funny how white amnesia sets in. Like, how do I pay for the debts? How do I pay for stuff that I've done wrong, or, you know, in the past? But, you know, listen, this is what the whole podcast is about. It's about the fact that if you can't see it and you don't think you owe it and there's no invoice, then how is it your debt? And there's the rub. So, yeah, you got to get to it. The other part of this is that you got interest. Okay, because this debt keeps growing whether you think it's there or not. It's like a mountain, so yeah, something's got to happen.
This is the big question that I think all white people ask themselves. Whether you're someone who believes that black people are owed something or whether you believe that black people aren't owed something, you're always like asking yourself, how do I fit into this? Do I owe something personally? Is it the government? And what does it actually mean to owe something? What is the thing that I've gotten by being white that I need to repay?
Well, I don't think it's what you've gotten only. It's what you can't see. And it is invisible because it's built inside the structures and the institutions and the banking and the real estate and the military and everything that makes America, America. But listen, I got the receipts and it dates back to how you and I both got started in life. And this will show the effects of the debt pretty clearly. In fact, to demonstrate the invisible advantages of your so-called magnificent whiteness and the unseen disparity of my glorious blackness, some genius created a contest called the Privilege Game. We're going to play it outdoors because we need plenty of room.
Actually, I know the perfect place to play this.
Okay, good.
So, Erica, you know, we're going to do this privilege walk, right? I thought it'd be interesting to do it at General Grant's tomb.
Wow.
Obviously, he was, you know, the winning general in the Civil War. But it was interesting, as president, he really went against Johnson, who replaced Lincoln. And he was really instrumental on ensuring rights for black people after Civil War.
I love the story of Grant.
You love the story of Grant?
I do. At least what I know about him is that he was a little small dude who wasn't necessarily the most obvious choice. But for Lincoln, who kept sending generals in and these types of commanders, they wouldn't fight. It's like they were hesitating, fighting against the South. And he says, God damn it, I need somebody who will fight. And Grant came in all small and kind of spiny. And he said, I'll fight, sir. And he fought. Yeah. Ooh. Love you, Grant. But let's get to this game. So the purpose is to demonstrate the different ways privilege shows up in our lives. So I've asked our friend, the brilliant Joy Reid of The Readout, to set us up and get us going. She's going to read a statement or a question, and we're going to step forward or step back if it applies to us. All right?
All right.
You want to take 20 steps up just being white and a man? Go for it. We'll work this out like a game. It'll be fun, at least for a little while.
Maybe fun for you. I have a feeling I might lose this one by winning.
You might lose this one. Is that a joke?
I'm saying my winning is going to be, could potentially be a loss.
Child, please, please. Delusions. Okay, let's get going.
All right, Erica and Whitney, let's play the privilege game. You ready?
Yes, my sister.
Ready as I'm ever going to be.
Now, good luck to both of you. Actually, I take that back, Whitney. You don't need luck. You've got white privilege. Good luck to you, Erica. I know your story. It's amazing. So many wonderful accomplishments. But even with all of that, I already know how this game will end. And it ain't with you in the lead, my Nubian sister. Okay, Wakanda forever. Let's do this. First question. If your ancestors were forced to come to the USA, not by choice, take one step back.
Bye. Let me just step back on GPs.
Okay, you just step forward.
If your primary ethnic identity is American, take one step forward.
That's me.
If you were ever called names because of your race, class, ethnicity, gender, or sexual orientation, take one step back.
There goes Erica. She's getting a little bit back behind me.
Whitney, you keep moving forward. I haven't moved forward once. Sucks for me.
If there were people who worked for your family as servants, gardeners, nannies, etc., take one step forward.
Here I go again.
If you were ever ashamed or embarrassed of your clothes, house, car, etc., take one step back.
We're getting farther apart pretty quickly.
Whitney, you might want to get out the middle of the center of the sidewalk. There you go.
All right, Whitney, so far you're in the lead by a pretty wide margin. So, Erica, now is probably a good time for us to set up some prayers that you'll catch up to him in the next round of the game. But first, speaking of reparations, I know you two visited New York's famous Riverside Church, whose history is connected to reparations. Let's take a listen.
Wow. What a church.
Yeah, this is a beauty. You know what I love? The stained glass. It looks like candy. It's delicious.
It's really, really, really astounding.
If they can build this, we can get reparations. It's true. Yeah. This was no small undertaking. No.
So, you know, this is the church where James Forman, in 1969, I think it was May 4th, he got up. There was a Sunday service, right?
Yep, and he got up.
You know, Reverend Ernest T. Campbell was presiding. Big crowd, mostly white.
Mostly presented. White.
Yeah, mostly white. Huh. And he got up and he presented the Black Manifesto.
That's right. You know, Whitney, James Forman was a well-known civil rights activist at the time, but when he stormed the pulpit and disrupted that service, he was heckled. I mean, they probably thought he was there to rob them. Black Manifesto. We, the Black people assembled in Detroit, Michigan, for the National Black Economic Development Conference, are fully aware that we have been forced to come together because racist white America has exploited our resources, our minds, our bodies, our labor. For centuries, we have been forced to live as colonized people inside the United States, victimized by the most vicious, racist system in the world. We have helped to build the most industrial country in the world.
The Riverside Church is to use its influence and historic reputation to pressure all white racist Christian churches and Jewish synagogues to meet the demand of the National Black Economic Development Conference for $500 million in reparations due to the role of the Christian and Jewish religions in exploiting black people in this country. We have stated in our Black Manifesto that our demand for $500 million cannot be minimized. It can only be increased. While we did not place a time limit on when we wanted the $500 million in reparations to be paid, let no Christian or Jew think that we are going to string out this matter or that payment of this reparation can be evaded.
We are therefore demanding of the white Christian churches and Jewish synagogues, which are part and parcel of the system of capitalism, that they begin to pay reparations to black people in this country. We are demanding $500 million
This total comes to $15 per nigger. Why did you read that part?
That's not the part I liked.
Now, wait a minute. I got to keep reading this nigger thing. This total comes to $15 per nigger. This is a low estimate. We maintain there are probably more than 30 million black people in this country. $15 a nigger is not a large sum of money, and we know that the churches and synagogues have a tremendous wealth in its membership, white America, and still exploits black people.
Time is running out. We have been slaves too long. The church has profited from our labor. The church is racist. We are men and women, proud black men and women. Our demands shall be met. Reparations or no church, victory or death. Thank you.
Now, there's a reason why he's using the word nigger. This was him manifesting. This, to me, channeling his anger. He was like, okay, you know what that is? That's $15 a nigger. Now, that, in a way, sounds like it's cheap. That's some heavy stuff. Oh, those, oh, I wish I could have seen those white people's faces. Oh, their ambrosia salad that morning. It got wilted. I never using nigger in a house of God. Yeah, but they baptized us and put us on slave ships. To me, nigger was invented in a house of God by godless people. So maybe if we flip it and we storm the Capitol, we can get $15 a nigger. And that's what he was asking for. He said, give us some money so we can do for ourselves. And he didn't get it.
No.
And we're still asking for it.
I know.
But I don't believe that America can last or be strong or go forward if it does not correct this huge crack in its foundation.
Think of the courage it took to come into this place and stand up in sort of the seat of religious power.
This was 1969. I don't think it took as much courage as you think. People were furious. I think that he was furious. So to me, I think he channeled his anger into something that he thought was at least productive. And said, I'm going to put a number to this. We're going to get some money for us. They owe us. And he was trying to compel them out of a sense of morality to beat them with the stick of justice.
Yeah, he was right. He started a national conversation on reparations around religion that had never been started before. And there was a huge, I mean, this was front page news. And it really, I mean, he did something. It was like a thunderclap, letting people know that this discussion about the church and exploitation of black Americans was joined.
Money. That's the number one reason America doesn't have a reparations program for the living ancestors of enslaved African Americans, because it'll cost her money, moolah. That's where the rubber meets the road. America's in debt to black people, monetarily and spiritually. You take it from early activists like Queen Mother Moore and your favorite, Whitney, Callie House, who are pioneers in the reparations movement.
You know, I love Callie, but really love James Forman. I mean, I think that what he did and what I think is like so fascinating about the manifesto is that it wasn't just so specific and like clear, but also the way that Reverend Campbell responded to it. I think that what he said something, and I'm paraphrasing him here, I can't really remember it, is something about, he said, you might not like what he said, you might not like the way he said it, but the questions he's posed are properly before the House. And so it really comes down to money, as you say. It's like what is owed, but also who is going to pay it.
That's true, but we can't oversimplify this because there are other necessary factors involved, like an apology for slavery, psychological damage, healing, reconciliation, untangling lots of heinous legislation that's cooked into the books. Yeah, but a big money payment is still be peanuts. I mean, in theory, it should be equal to the amount of money enslaved Africans have earned in labor unpaid. Funding we blacks invested in you, white America. The debt has come due, Whitney, and the bill is staggering. How much you got in your pockets, player?
Yeah, you know, Erica, me, not very much. And I think that's kind of how a lot of white Americans feel, like they don't necessarily have a lot of money, and what they do, they've worked really hard for, and they don't see the advantages that, you know, they might not have money in their pocket, but they have something else. They have opportunities and advantages that really can't be calculated. And I think that's kind of the question we're exploring here. You know, what is the number that can make up not only for what was taken with Black Americans, but also for what was not given?
Right. So James Forman, this disruptor, he visited Reverend Campbell the night before his Sunday stunt to ask him for permission to address the service. I mean, he was trying to do it the right way, but Campbell declined. So Forman did his thing. And you heard the congregation booing. I wish I was there to see it. But, you know, he was undaunted. Campbell came back strong, though. After a regroup that same Sunday, he spoke about Forman's manifesto. He spoke about the evils of the white man and the Black man's mistreatment from the white men. But he also says that whites have inherited this system. Now, this is where it starts to get a little dodgy. And he posits that there's a statute of limitations. You got to get that. Lone limitation on the pain and suffering of Black people. But there is a limit on the time that white people have to rectify, recognize, and repair the destruction of Black citizens, their most valuable asset creators.
You know, he acknowledges the validity of the question. I'm not sure he's ready for the answer that a full accounting is going to provide. I mean, that's really the question, right, Erica? What is the number? How do you quantify what is owed?
Well, if we're talking about the debt, then we got to talk to Uber economist Dr. William Darity. And he's got numbers. I mean, Whitney, you know, he wasn't always for reparations. He was a skeptic.
I see reparations as something that is supposed to be rejuvenative of a community that has been long, long decimated by American racism. But I don't necessarily see that as being a process that would inflict any type of unique harm on the non-Black population of the United States.
That's a huge relief for me to hear, I gotta say.
I don't see reparations as a matter of individual or personal guilt. I see it as a matter of national responsibility and obligation. And I can't say what the consequences would be for the country as a whole if it never happens. It hasn't happened in 156 years. But I certainly can have the expectation that Black lives will continue to be stunted and denied full opportunity if a step like this is not taken.
Take us through a little bit, like what you believe the debt is and how you're calculating it.
The Black American population that is descended from persons enslaved in the U.S. is about 13% of the nation's population, but possesses about 2.5% of the nation's wealth. This corresponds to a situation in which the average Black household has a net worth that is now almost $850,000 less than the average white household. We view that racial wealth differential as capturing the cumulative intergenerational effects of racism in American society. We set as the target for a reparations plan elimination of that gap and bringing the Black share of wealth into consistency with the Black share of the nation's population. And that would require at least $10 to $12 trillion in resources to be transferred to Black Americans.
And how are you calculating that number?
So we estimate, based upon the Federal Reserve Survey of Consumer Finances, that the total required per household would be about $850,000. There are approximately 15 million households that consist of persons who are descendants of the folks who were enslaved in the United States. And so simply by multiplying that 15 million by approximately 850,000, you come up with that number.
Hi, it's Joy Reid again, and we're back with the next round of the Privilege Game. They're still pretty far apart, but let's get into the next round of questions to see if Erica can catch up to Whitney. Erica and Whitney, can both of you still hear me?
Kinda.
I can hear you better than I can hear Erica.
I knew you guys would be far apart, but wow, you can't even talk to each other now.
Yeah, whatever.
Here's the next question. If one or both of your parents were white-collar professionals, doctors, lawyers, etc., take one step forward.
Here I go.
Oh, Whitney's really moving.
If you were raised in an area where there was prostitution, drug activity, etc., take one step back.
I'm good.
We're both standing in place.
If you ever tried to change your appearance, mannerisms, or behavior to avoid being judged or ridiculed, take one step back.
Well, we probably all did, right? No? No, you're still standing. Damn.
If you studied the culture of your ancestors in elementary school, take one step forward.
That's definitely me.
It looks like a dot here.
If you went to school speaking a language other than English, take one step back.
Look at them. Every step, he just keeps moving and moving. Oh, man.
Wow, Whitney, you're a mile away. This is an absolute bloodletting. Erica, girl, I can see how this is going to end. But I'm looking at the time, and I got to go. I need to get ready for my TV show, The Readout. Catch you two later.
We'll see you, Joy.
Thanks, Joy, to the world. White privilege. Not just white privilege. This is about privilege. It's not just DNA. It's also the luck. But you know, I feel lucky, even though I'm way back here. Shoot, don't tell me I'm not lucky.
Okay, so, Erica, I can see you. Can you hear me, Erica?
Yeah.
Are we far away from each other?
Yeah, we started off in the middle of the block. You're almost at the end. I'm still in the middle, but further from the middle. I hope you appreciate this privilege.
Hope he appreciates it. You know what, though? I'm starting to realize, man, I did pretty good, not knowing that I didn't have all these advantages.
If you've ever been cast on a major network sitcom and been the star of stage and screen, take 500 steps forward. Wait, Erica's coming. She's coming fast. Whoop, she's blowing by me, and she... Now she's out of sight.
41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50.
Woo! That's what network TV does for you. I blew right past you, Whitney. So long, Whitey.
What did we learn here?
That being white and male is a good thing.
And being a star of stage, screen is a great thing.
Yeah, but it didn't make up for all that other stuff. Okay, I'm coming up now.
We were talking about you being an actor and famous, but that's... everything else on this question is just everyday things, and that's what separates it out. Not everybody gets to be cast in TV shows and movies.
So it was like winning the lottery that changed my life.
Yeah.
And that's absurd, that you have to win the lottery in order to get some sort of balancing factor.
And it's what I said to you earlier at one point, is that I don't want to give up what I have. I want everybody to have what I have.
But what I don't believe that you can have everything you have without black people having to give up everything. So you must give up something.
So that's what we're sort of exploring. I think that a lot of times people say, oh, it's not a zero-sum game. I do agree that it is a zero-sum game, that there is going to, you have to give up to get something. So, but that was interesting. That was fun.
That was fun for you because you kept moving forward. What are you talking about? Oh, that was fun. Oh, you know what? It's like when you go to an amusement park and you're wondering because you've been standing in line all day and there's a family and they just move forward and you go, man, they must got the hookup. That's what it's like for black people looking at white people, that you're always thinking they've got the hookup. It's not even a joke with us. We know we look at white people and they automatically, they got the hookup. Privilege is the hookup.
Privilege is the hookup.
See you later, Ulysses Grant. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, so Whitney, the privilege game ended like we knew it would. But a powerful way to change the results of the game is through reparations. Now, I know it's no magic bullet. I got it. But it beats the slow death of 1,000 cuts African Americans are experiencing now. We need to talk to some folks who can help us do the math and calculate what's owed so we can get going on this. I mean, please, I don't want to keep playing that game again and just keep losing.
My name is Bob Johnson. I'm the founder of Black Entertainment Television and the RLJ Companies.
Ooh, Bobby J. Okay, right. Now, he has been on record for demanding the U.S. government pay $14 trillion to the descendants of slaves, and he makes a hell of a case. And he also believes that black Americans are giving away their wealth because they are left out of the many incentives of home ownership.
The biggest transfer of wealth, if you think about this, home ownership. When you own a home, two things happen. One, the government gives you a tax deduction for the interest you pay on the homeowner mortgage. So one, the government is subsidizing your home. And the second thing is, home ownership has been the backbone of wealth creation in this society. And so the home appreciates. And when you sell it, you have more money than when you invested in it. So white Americans own about 70%, the ratio of home ownership in white Americans, about 70%. Black Americans, about 40%. So white Americans own more homes than Black Americans and therefore get the benefit of the tax deduction and the appreciation. Now, Black Americans are subsidizing that because if they don't have the down payment for the home, they have to rent. When you rent, as anybody who knows who rents an apartment or rents any kind of property knows, you don't get a tax deduction for renting an apartment in the urban markets or any place. So you are, in effect, paying the same tax. So if you make $40,000, your tax is on your $40,000 of income. But you don't get that tax deduction, which reduces your tax. The white American who has access to capital can get that tax deduction. That's a wealth transfer. So many Black families who rent are subsidizing white ownership because they are not getting the tax deduction. They're paying full tax while a white American can deduct the tax on their home ownership because that's the federal government rule. And so that's a wealth transfer. Labor is a wealth transfer. Access to paying taxes greater than the other person is a wealth transfer.
And so where does that money come from to transfer that money back? Are you saying just to take it out of the budget? Should there be a reparations tax? What is the way that you create that revenue?
Same way the government always creates revenue. You get the revenue from the individual taxpayers in this country. Keep in mind, there's no such thing as government money. Now, government can print money and create more money. But fundamentally, the way the government pays for itself, for military expenses, healthcare expenses, social services, is by taxing people. So it's ultimately, the money belongs to the people. So reparations is a way of saying to the people of this country, 300 million plus people, 40 million Black, is saying, look, we need to repair our nation by giving everybody an equal opportunity and paying damages for people who were treated horribly for more than 200 plus years.
Economist Dr. Julianne Malveau, I love her, made the case for reparations in 2019 when she testified at the H.R. 40 hearing, which calls for the establishment of a commission to study reparations for Black Americans.
People are very uncomfortable talking about what they owe us. It's very uncomfortable to talk about the fact that the foundations of our nation's economy rest on the backs of Black people. We would not have a Wall Street, a bond market, absent Black labor, absent extracting the value of the work of enslaved Black people. But when you begin to talk about that from an economic perspective, people get really very uncomfortable because then you also have to talk about the nature of capitalism. You have to talk about something called predatory capitalism. Predatory capitalism gives you the ability to thingify people, to basically dehumanize people. Dr. King called it thingify. You know, when we talk about reparations, we've got a piece of legislation, a powerful piece of legislation, H.R. 40, which would essentially set up a commission to look at what form reparations might take. I believe that there's a combination remedy that includes the repair of our communities. We had 100 plus Black-owned banks in the early 20th century. Now we have 23. But what did we lose? And we lost lots because essentially it was a time period where Black people were making advances even though we didn't get the 40 acres and mule. And then white folks bucked up and said, wait a minute, these people are moving too far, too fast. We need to stop this stuff. And that's where you got the lynchings, the Jim Crow laws.
Give us a tab. What's the bill?
We can calculate the value of enslaved work from 1619 to 1865. But we can also calculate the value of extorted work from 1865 to 1965. We can also talk about the value, what has happened with economic discrimination and the value of that from 1965 until the present. We could look at the Emergency Land Fund, which is an organization that looked at the loss of Black land and how we had land and they took it away from us. We could talk about the Black people who were banished, the sundown towns. One day you wake up and they say, y'all got to get out of town right now. So there's so many pieces that you can calculate. And this is the reckoning that our country has to have. You have a wealth gap where you have one Black dollar for right now for every 13 white dollars today. In 1910, it was one Black dollar for every 16. So think about that. In a course of more than 100 years, we made that little progress. Now, the number does go up and down, but 116, 113. And it really does speak to why reparations are important.
And who gets these reparations? And how are they divvied up?
I feel more strongly about community repair than individual repair, but many feel there should be some check cut some kind of way. Okay, I'm not going to strongly object to that. If we believe that it's not just enslavement, but also the post-enslavement period, the GI Bill, the Homestead Act, all of that exclusion, if you believe that, then whether you got here in 1619 or in 1919 or even in 1969, you've experienced some form of damage because of this oppressive system. How do we slice the pie? Let's get a pie first, and then let's talk about it.
Right on, Julianne. And if there's gonna be pie, I'll take a huge piece of pecan. Oh, and Whitney, on Capitol Hill, wait, I'll use my upper crust voice. We had movement on H.R. 40. When football legend Herschel Walker lent his expertise in soaring rhetoric to the reparations testimony going on in Congress, let's listen in.
We use Black power to create white guilt. My approach is biblical. How can I ask my Heavenly Father to forgive me if I can't forgive my brother? I never want to put anyone's religion down, but my religion teaches togetherness. Reparation teaches separation. Many have died trying to get into America. No one is dying trying to get out. Reparation, where will the money come from? Who is Black? What percentage of Black must you be to receive reparation? If reparation is a fee or a correction for a terrible sin of slave owners, government, and others, but we punish the non-guilty party, is it not creating division, a separation with different races? Reparation, I feel it continues to let us know we're still African American rather than just American.
No, not exactly a touchdown, but in all fairness, just because Herschel's on the field doesn't mean he's on your team. So I don't think one should throw him the reparations football and not expect a fumble. Ciao, please. Good luck, Sheila Jackson Lee. Next time on Reparations, the Big Payback, we meet the trailblazers of the reparations movement.
Callie Huss was a Black woman who had been a slave, and the federal government got concerned. They decided, because letters were coming from white people saying, the Negroes are meeting in churches, and they come out singing, talking about someday we're going to get something. So you need to do something about that woman who's going around here stirring them up. And so they decided to go after her, and they said that she was using the mails to defraud because she was telling Black people that she was going, Negroes, that she was going to try to get the federal government to give them some money, and she should know the federal government is never going to give Negroes any money. That's the way they put it. So it was fraud to be organizing people. And so you can trace the present-day reparations movement all the way back to Callie House and her ex-slave pension movement.
This podcast is produced by Eric Alexander, Ben Arnon, and Whitney Dow. The executive producers are Charlemagne the God and Dolly S. Bishop. The supervising producer is Nicole Childers, and the lead producer is Devin Mavic Robbins. The producer-writer is Cerise Castle, and the associate producer is Kevin Pham, with additional research support provided by Niall Blass. Original music by DJ DTP.
Reparations, the Big Payback is a production of Color Farm Media, iHeartRadio, and the Black Effect Podcast Network in association with Best Case Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.